thanks a lot for inviting me. So it was a lot of fun to come back to Santa Barbara. Let's see, so I'm going to be talking about some work that I've been doing over the last couple of years with Dan Kabat and Gilad Lifshitz, and more recently with one of Dan's students, Nori Izuka. So we've been looking at how one recovers black hole entropy and the whole 10-dimensional space-time from the quantum mechanics of these zero-brain black holes. I'll also tell you a little bit at the end about some scattering calculations that we've recently been doing that has not yet been published. Let's see, so the basic plan is to study these zero-brain quantum mechanics in the TUFT large end limit. So let me just write down what the quantum mechanics is so we're all on the same page. So the bosonic part of the quantum mechanics, if I write down the Hamiltonian, it's some sum over momentum terms, and then there's a potential term that is the square of the commutator of some set of n by n Hermitian matrices. And this index I runs from 1 to 9, which will be related to the nine spatial dimensions. Okay, so that's the bosonic part. There's also some fermionic terms, and the whole quantum mechanics has 16 supercharges. Okay, so we're going to use this conjectured version of the Maldacena duality for these zero brains that was conjectured by Itzhaki and others some time ago. It's a little bit more subtle than the regular Maldacena duality for anti-de Sitter space versus conformal field theory. Well, say more about that in a moment. What we're going to try to do is to really develop some techniques to understand this quantum mechanics of strong coupling. So we're going to develop a kind of Hartree-Fock mean field type of approximation for looking at this quantum mechanics. And we're going to focus on computing this set of quantities. We're going to look at black hole entropy. We'll be able to compute the density of states that accounts for the black hole entropy. And then we'll set about trying to recover the actual bulk space-time directly from the quantum mechanics. In particular, we can reproduce the Born-Enfeld action from the quantum mechanics, this so-called probe, looking at a probe brain and computing its effective potential. And lastly, we can talk about actually trying to measure the area of the horizon of this black hole by looking at scattering processes and applying the mean field to those quantities. Okay, so we'll be able to get lots of qualitative as well as very detailed quantitative insights into how this entire 10-dimensional space-time emerges from the quantum mechanics. Okay, so let me just say a few words about how this, what the status of this is for the usual Maldacena duality, where one has anti-de Sitter space cross a sphere. So as you know, that's dual to some conformal field theory, which has an SUN gauge group, anyone with 16 supercharges, and one is taking this TUFT large N limit with the string coupling times N held fixed at large. Okay, so one thing one can do is look at black holes in this asymptotically anti-de Sitter space. And it's actually fairly straightforward to do a computation of the entropy. both on the conformal field theory side and, of course, just computing the area of the horizon of the black hole, which gives us the Bekenstein-Hilking entropy. So if you look at black holes that are much larger than the radius of curvature of the anti-de Sitter space, you can compute the entropy, and it agrees with the entropy you get from the conformal field theory, which you could get just by simple dimensional analysis. It should just be proportional to the volume of the conformal field theory times the temperature cubed, being an extensive quantity, and then the temperature dependence is fixed just by dimensional analysis. So that agrees with the Bekenstein-Hilking entropy up to some overall numerical factor. So you can see that kind of agreement more or less for free. But if you were to try and do more detailed calculations, you'd really need to do some calculations in the gauge theory at strong coupling. And the most interesting quantities are quantities that aren't protected by supersymmetry. So there aren't really any techniques for doing that kind of calculation other than something like lattice gauge theory. So what I'll be talking about today is how one might try to set up some direct gauge theory calculations in a somewhat simpler example, the example given by this type of duality for D0 brains. So let me say a little bit about how that works. So you're going to take a set of N V0 brains located at the same point and take this same kind of Malvasina limit where one sends the string coupling to zero while sending the mass of the string scale to infinity. And in this limit, something kind of peculiar happens to the geometry in the string frame. So here I'm plotting the size of a transverse sphere versus some radial direction. As we move out here, we asymptote to flat space. But as we come in, we encounter this singular throat region. And as we take this this limit and make G string n very large, this becomes very, very strongly coupled. Very strong curvature here. But we're left with this kind of bubble of space-time where the curvature is small. And what we're going to be interested in is some small black hole, or some black hole sitting in this bubble of space-time. So the way this Itzhaki-Maldacena duality works is that this supergravity in this bubble of space-time is supposed to be dual to the D0 brain quantum mechanics of the Tuft limit. Okay, so the actual metric we get looks like this. So you can see, so this is in the string frame again, so you can see this transverse sphere is increasing as you decreases. If we have a black hole in this space-time, we'll get some horizon at this value U0, and that generates some non-trivial Hilking temperature. So the Hilking temperature will vanish when U0 vanishes. So we can go ahead and compute the area of such a the horizon area of such a black hole and apply the usual Bekenstein-Hilking formula. And when you do that, you get this this type of expression. Here I'm expressing it in terms of the free energy of the system. So a couple of interesting points. We get this rather non-trivial critical exponent with scaling with the temperature, and that's something we'll try to reproduce using the mean field approximation to the quantum mechanics. And another important feature to notice is this factor of n squared out front. That's kind of suggesting that in this limit, this entropy can be accounted for by n squared independent degrees of freedom. And then we see the Tuft coupling constant appearing here. So this is a dimensionful quantity in the quantum mechanics. Okay.
So I guess this is the Einstein metric here, written down here on the top.
This is the
That's the string metric.
That's the string metric, I think.
I see. You want to compute the area in the Einstein metric.
That's right. Yeah.
Because that's what you have to.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the dilaton is also a function of u.
Maybe that explains. I was just puzzled because it looks like that 1/u^3 means that your spheres are monotonically decreasing in size as you increase the radius.
Yeah. Here I've taken this decoupling limit. So this metric is just describing this half of things.
It's getting bigger. And then they're getting smaller again.
So the horizon, I guess, is doing something there.
Horizon is big. Right?
Yeah.
We want a fairly big black hole.
Fairly big black hole. Let's see. So the when we actually compute the area of the horizon of the black hole, the dilaton dependence causes the black hole to be very small for small perturbations away from externality. So it kind of cancels that, this inverse u^3/2 dependence. So the dilaton
is the Einstein metric, and this is the string metric.
This is the string metric, yeah. And the dilaton is going something like something like -21/4, if I remember correctly.
The picture
that you drew with the bubble is the Einstein metric? I'm not sure if you should read too much into this part of this diagram. It's shrinking as we move out, and there's some black hole sitting at this end. And out here we move off into asymptotically flat space. Yeah, maybe this should have. So the dilaton doesn't depend on this quantity u0 at all. And that's a point I'll come back to later. So you can see from here that we have what is just a very standard Schwarzschild. This u coordinate is essentially a Schwarzschild-like radial coordinate. Okay. Yeah. So that diagram is maybe it should have continued out and then drawn a black hole. Doesn't matter too much. Okay, so let me talk about the quantum mechanics a little more now. So the conjecture is that the quantum mechanics is dual to the interior of this bubble in this Tuft large end limit. So the way I'm going to formulate all the calculations today is using this Euclidean time formulation of the finite temperature quantum mechanics. So I'll be thinking of the space-time in terms of the Euclidean black hole, and using the fact that one can match the time direction of the quantum mechanics with the time direction of the space-time, the Hawking temperature of the black hole just maps directly into this temperature in the quantum mechanics. Okay, and another point, once I've got this dimensionful temperature, I can use that to define some dimensionless effective coupling. So what I'll do is just choose units where g squared n is 1, and then adjust the temperature in order to adjust the effective strength of the coupling. So be interested in this limit where the temperature is becoming very small. That will be this strong coupling limit where we get supergravity with small curvature. Okay, so the hope is by doing all this for the D0 brain quantum mechanics rather than the full 3 plus 1 dimensional Yang-Mills theory is that we maybe stand a better chance of doing some direct calculations in the quantum mechanics. Okay, so I'll just show you a picture of the kind of phase diagram we're talking about here. So if we plot either energy or using these ideas from ADS-CFT, we can think of this radial coordinate U in the bulk geometry as a kind of energy in the quantum mechanics. And of course, the temperature in the quantum mechanics is also of the same dimension. So either we can adjust energies for fixed temperature or adjust the temperature for holding other quantities fixed. And we run through this series of phases when we do that. If we're looking at very high energies in the quantum mechanics or equivalently very high temperatures, the perturbative quantum mechanics is valid. Our dimensionless coupling is small in that regime. But when we map that into the gravitational solution, we find the curvature in the string frame is large. Okay, so this Tuft coupling to the 1/3 power sets that energy scale. So what we're mostly going to be interested in is this region here where we're at energies below g squared n to the 1/3. So in my units, this is going to appear at a scale of order 1. So we move down below that scale, the quantum mechanics becomes strongly coupled, but the curvature becomes weak and supergravity becomes valid. And as we go down to ever lower energies, we start to enter this matrix black hole regime where one has a black hole up in 11 dimensions. So the dilaton becomes large down here, and one really needs to lift this 10-dimensional black hole solution up to 11 dimensions. But that appears at this rather peculiar scale, and you'll notice the Tuft coupling doesn't appear in setting this scale. So if we take this large n limit, then this scale will essentially just shrink down to zero, and we can forget about this part of the phase diagram in the Tuft large n limit. Okay, so that will actually be something of an advantage for us because we know the correlations between the entries in the matrices become very complicated here. We're sort of, the matrices are forced on to sit on this moduli space where the matrices are close to being diagonal. We'll find in this regime, because we have some finite temperature, that essentially all the entries in the matrices can be treated on the same footing. So that will give us some major simplifications in setting up a description of this. Okay, so that's more or less what I just said. We notice in this Tuft limit that the entropy scales as n squared, which suggests we should be able to, since the entries in the matrices are the obvious n squared degrees of freedom that we have sitting around, then it suggests we should be able to treat each of those entries as some independent degree of freedom moving in some mean field background due to all the other entries. And to formulate this, we'll use a kind of Gaussian trial action. So we'll introduce this trial action with this set of unknown propagators that we want to solve for. So we're going to be using this imaginary time formulation of the quantum mechanics. So these modes here will be the Matsubara frequency modes, 2 pi L over beta. So we'll introduce some set of unknown propagators. When we actually come to solving them, we'll put in some ultraviolet cutoff here, and we'll check that that cutoff doesn't affect our answers. So we'll introduce a set of these propagators for each of the degrees of freedom in the quantum mechanics. Let's see, that kind of... Yeah, we also treat the fermions and the gauge modes, and we need to worry about ghost fields. And we use a superfield formulation of things, so we also have to worry about the auxiliary fields. And this is why it took us a couple of years to grind through all this. So yeah, there's a lot of technical details suppressed in those three dots there that I won't trouble you with today.
So these are the
n by n matrices, but instead of working with them as a function of time, we're working in frequency space. So we kind of have frequencies given by 2 pi L over beta, and we're working in this Matsubara formulation where the time direction is a circle with circumference beta.
Why is it Gaussian?
Yeah, that's just going to be our ansatz.
Before you go to an approximation like this mean thing.
Yeah, so I haven't made an approximation yet, but okay. I will be in a moment.
I just wanted to make sure I understood what the sort of thing you want to calculate. So if we were just given a quantum mechanical problem, you're looking at low temperatures, so this is you're really looking at low energy states.
Yeah.
And you're interested in sort of how many low energy states there are in this sort of quantum mechanics.
Yeah. So the first quantity we'll calculate will just be the free energy, which should be dominated by these low energy states. And we're actually going to first compute all these two-point functions of all the matrices and construct the free energy in terms of those. Okay. Okay, so with such a trial action, we can always make some expansion of the free energy in terms of quantities evaluated with respect to this Gaussian measure. So essentially all we're doing is doing a trivial rewriting of a partition function, e to the minus s naught. I guess people can't see over here, but sticking a minus move that over. So we're just doing a trivial rewriting of the partition function. And then doing a Taylor expansion of e to the minus s minus s naught. Okay, so if we could choose the propagators in a somewhat miraculous way, we could arrange that all these higher order terms vanished, and then the leading, the zeroth order term would compute the exact free energy. Of course, doing that is kind of hard, but all we're doing is doing some resummation of perturbation theory by using this formulation of things. So the approximation comes in when we actually try and write down some set of equations to fix these unknown propagators, these sigma L's. So the tack we'll take that has seen some success in, for example, computing Wilson loops in the ADS CFT correspondence is to do some resummation, not of all of planar diagrams, but find some convenient subset that one can handle. So the way we'll do that is to look at the Schwinger-Dyson equations for a dressed propagator. So that's equal to some free propagator plus these types of terms. This would be an exact equation if we dressed the vertices here. So we have these dressed two-point functions propagating around the loops. And if we dress the vertices here, we would get an exact Schwinger-Dyson equation. The truncation will be to replace the dressed vertices just by the bare vertices. So doing that, we get this, a resummation of some subset of all the planar diagrams. Okay. Okay. So since we're just including planar diagrams in this scheme, we'll automatically respect the Tuft counting. We're going to be treating each entry in the matrices as being independent, so we'll get some automatic factorization of this n squared in front of the free energy. And in principle, we can respect all the global symmetries of the quantum mechanics, although since we're choosing superfields in order to ensure that supersymmetry is recovered exactly at zero temperature, we're forced to make some breaking of this SO9 symmetry down to SO7 cross SO2. Okay, so in the end, we wind up with some set of algebraic equations with some number of unknowns that depends on our frequency cutoff. And
is rank just the rainbow
graph? Yeah. So once we introduce the superfield formulation, we don't just get these quartic vertices, we get these, we get a mixture of quartic and cubic vertices with some of these auxiliary fields propagating around. So it's a kind of mixture of rainbow graphs and bubble graphs. I'm not sure there's a good name for it. Okay, so we wind up with a set of algebraic equations to solve, and finding an analytic solution turns out to be rather complicated. If we just keep a few modes, we can do that, but that doesn't give us the right answer that we're looking for. So we wound up keeping a fairly large number of modes and solving the equations numerically using a Newton method. And in the end, we do wind up getting quite nice agreement with the gravity prediction for the free energy from the Bekenstein-Hawking results. So
as you're getting both the negative exponent and the prefactor.
Well, we don't get the prefactor. So let's see. So here I'm showing beta times the free energy versus this inverse temperature beta. So the straight line is the supergravity prediction where we've essentially adjusted the overall numerical coefficient by hand, and we're comparing the shape of the trajectories, the shape of the results. So once we, as soon as this inverse temperature goes above one, where things start to become strongly coupled, it seems to match very well with the kind of scaling we get from supergravity. And this works over some range of inverse temperature. So the actual dimensionless coupling is going like the cube of this inverse temperature. So we're getting up to fairly large dimensionless couplings. And then after, if we go too far, then this mean field approximation starts to break down. So
for beta less than one, you're in the regime where the gauge theory is weakly coupled.
That's right.
And then what's the free energy like there?
Yes, there we see a logarithmic dependence on the temperature.
There's a kink in the full curve.
Yeah, let me show you that on the next transparency. So we look at the energy of the black hole, just this derivative of the free energy. And we can look at that over a wider range on this log-log plot. So out here where the perturbative quantum mechanics is good, we get a logarithmic dependence on beta. And then it moves over into this kind of shoulder region where we enter this scaling regime, and here we've plotted the supergravity prediction, and there's some overall constant which shifts that upwards. And then if we go to too high an inverse temperature, things start to break down.
Is the sort of reason you can't get the overall coefficient just that depends on higher order terms, or the mean field approximation isn't good enough?
Let's see. So it may be that the higher order terms are kind of scaling in the same way with temperature, but do make up for this. It depends exactly what you mean by the higher order terms. So there are corrections to our free energy that we're dropping that give us a certain set of higher order terms that are not included in this calculation. So one might hope that those would push us in the right direction, but there are also all these planar diagrams that we're not including, and those wouldn't appear at all in this kind of calculation we're doing here. And one would hope that those would make up for the deficit there. Okay.
So you don't have any direct control
of those. Let's see. So something we've looked at. So we're computing this free energy in this expansion in S minus S naught. What was it?
I guess
so,
without
the gauge zero mode, that's right. And so we can compute higher order terms in this expansion, and there's some cubic term that we include And we can also add in some quartic term. Okay, so something that we can check is that this term is much smaller than these other terms. So it seems like this expansion is convergent. That's right, yeah. So what we wind up doing is choosing a supersymmetric version of Feynman gauge. So on the gauge field, we have a condition that's something like this. But in 0 plus 1 dimensions, this is essentially a physical gauge choice. This fixes all of the gauge modes to be 0 except for the 0 mode. And we wind up having to treat the 0 mode in a rather special way, which I won't get into unless you want to hear it at the end. Okay, so let me move on. So we've computed all these propagators. So having checked that the entropy and the free energy works out quite well, we can start looking at space-time structure. And maybe the first thing to check is a conjecture by Joe looking at the by using the virial theorem. The conjecture was that the trace of x squared in this quantum mechanics should just be proportional to g squared n to the 1/3. So in particular, it should be independent of the temperature. And that's something that we reproduce quite well. So here's a plot of one of these propagators. So more or less as soon as we get into this strongly coupled regime, as beta becomes greater than 1, this two-point function is completely flattens out. So this other line is, well, we get this breaking of the SO9 symmetry due to our choice of superfields. So this is the SO2's worth of scalars and showing their propagator. And this other line here is the size of the horizon of the black hole plotted on the same scale. Just to give you some idea of how big the black hole is on this plot. So one thing you'll notice is that this size of the space-time in the quantum mechanics is becoming quite a bit larger than that of the size of the black hole. So what we're really computing here, because we're including very high frequency modes, is not just the size of the black hole, but the kind of size of the entire bubble of space-time. So we're looking at very high energy stringy modes in computing this expectation value, corresponding to strings running from one end of the bubble to the other. Okay, so what we'd like to do to get a better picture of the space-time structure is to put in some kind of frequency cutoff when we compute such a propagator. Okay, so to handle that in a nicer way, what we do is go through the same kind of mean field approximation for a probe brain sitting in the background of ND0 brains. So we just give an expectation value to one of these X's that represents some D0 brain probe sitting at some distance from the collection of ND0 brains. And the kind of thing that we can compute on the supergravity side is, say, the Born-Enfeld action for this probe brain. So that depends in a very sensitive way on the structure of the space-time metric. And we can also compute the mass of a string stretching between the probe and the horizon of the black hole, just evaluating the Nambu-Gatto action. And that takes this very simple form. So what we're going to try and do is reproduce both of these from the quantum mechanics. And we're going to need to use one relation to kind of fix this relationship between this space-time u-coordinate and this vacuum expectation value of in the quantum mechanics. But once we have fixed that relationship, we then get a whole function's worth of independent checks by making the comparison of this other quantity. Okay, so we basically just set up the same kind of Hartree-Fock approximation for the quantum mechanics, splitting up the matrices into n by n and a column of 1 by n fields that transform in the fundamental rep of SUN. And we introduce this vacuum expectation value, which we'll call R. So we then need to set up some equations that describe the propagators of these fundamental fields. And that we do in a very similar way to what we did before. We get some set of propagators, and then what we want to do is extract the density of states of these propagators. So we know the left-hand side here, and we'd like to invert this integral to find out what the density of states is. And I guess I spent most of last summer trying to do this. Ended up using some numerical techniques that geologists use for seismic mapping and what Hubble Space Telescope people use for image deconvolution. And you wind up with this kind of picture. If we start out with a probe that's far away, we get we get some single peak, which is more or less what you'd expect from the quantum mechanics. As we bring the probe into this more strongly coupled region, what we find is this single peak starts to split into two peaks. But the really interesting thing happens when we try and bring the probe brain in towards the horizon. And then we see this very interesting structure that the peaks actually become very, very sharp. And there's, again, this bimodal distribution. So we're bringing the probe in towards the horizon. The color represents the different values of this expectation value R. As we bring the probe in, one peak moves to lower frequencies, but this other peak moves out to higher frequencies. So it seems fairly clear from that we have kind of two sets of modes corresponding to strings that are running between the probe and the horizon, but some other set that are running from the probe out towards this strongly coupled region. So they become longer as the probe approaches the horizon of the black hole. And as we send R to zero, the frequency doesn't go to zero. Instead, it goes to something of order the temperature of the black hole. Okay. Yeah.
So when you say move it closer to the horizon, you're decreasing R.
Yeah.
Now, wouldn't you expect that the strings that go from the probe out to infinity are going to become more and more massive?
Yeah, that's what that's showing.
So these
are moving to higher frequency. Yeah. Okay, so now it's fairly clear where we should put our ultraviolet cutoff in order to extract the light degrees of freedom that supposedly have something to do with the space-time geometry. Okay, so from those density of states, we can extract the masses of these W particles, these masses of strings running between the probe and the horizon. And as I mentioned before, this curve kind of asymptotes to something of order the temperature of the black hole. Out here, there's some straight line dependence that comes from the relation between the expectation value and U, which is just a linear relation in the extremal case. and we get corrections that set in when this radial coordinate becomes of order this horizon size U0. Okay, so that fixes, this plot essentially fixes this relationship between our expectation value in the quantum mechanics and this supergravity coordinate U. Okay, so we can then compare the Born-Enfeld potential. So we just compute the free energy of the probe and compare that with the Born-Enfeld potential. And again, I'm going to adjust some overall normalization factor in making this comparison. And I use that previous result, fixing the relationship between R and U, and this is what we get. This is for black holes at two different temperatures. This is the result of the mean field solution, and the straight line is the Born-Enfeld potential for that black hole, again adjusted by some overall normalization factor. Okay, so we see only pretty good agreement out here in this strongly coupled region, and then as we get very close to the horizon at a radial scale of order the temperature of the black hole, we see some deviations from the Born-Enfeld potential. But I guess would have expected those, since as we bring we're considering holding the probe fixed as we bring it in towards the horizon, so we're having to accelerate it to keep it at that fixed radius. And as we bring it very close, these accelerations become of order the string scale. So we should think of these as some kind of alpha prime corrections to the Born-Enfeld action.
So is that on that plot, R equals zero is set at the horizon?
Yes. Okay, so in the quantum mechanics, we have this probe brain, and it gets assimilated by this collective of N brains as R becomes of order the temperature. So we're seeing a kind of smooth transition from this probe brain to actual horizon degree of freedom, and that free energy for the probe matches the free energy for the black hole at the point where R equals zero. Okay, so this transition happens at a much smaller scale than the horizon scale, which is set by U0. So we're kind of seeing evidence for a kind of stringy stretched horizon where these alpha prime effects are becoming important. Okay, so the final topic I wanted to talk about is trying to measure the horizon area via scattering. So first one needs to come up with some operational definition of how you would measure an area by scattering in this curved background. So the line I'll take is to consider some observer who's sitting inside this inside this bubble of space-time, but fairly far from the black hole, and this observer is going to shine something like a laser beam on the black hole and move it in the transverse directions until he finds the laser is no longer absorbed by the black hole. So we're going to consider scattering in a kind of geometric optics limit where the frequency of the scattered light is much larger than the size of the horizon of the black hole, but still much smaller than the than g squared n to the 1/3. Okay, so in order to come up with some operational definition of this area, one of the facts I'll use is the fact that in the extremal metric,
the extremal metric is just conformal to flat space. So if we make this change of coordinates between this coordinate u and some new coordinate z, we see the metric is really just conformal to flat space. So we can set up this kind of scattering calculation in this conformal metric using all the symmetries of flat space. So we'll, that's essentially what we'll do. In order to do that, we really need to consider scattering of some conformally coupled field, and I'll just do a scalar field to keep it simple. I guess you might object that there aren't any conformally coupled fields in this supergravity, but that actually doesn't matter too much, because if we're in this geometric optics limit, then any scalar field will behave like it's conformally coupled, as long as we stay away from the regions of strong curvature. That region of strong curvature is kind of out at the distant edges of this bubble. So as long as we're sitting inside this bubble and scattering things in towards the black hole, this is going to be a good approximation. So in this conformally coupled, in this conformally related flat metric, the scalar field is just going to propagate along straight lines. So I can just about manage to figure out how it scatters. So some observer is then just going to make some transverse measurement of the size of the black hole with respect to these flat coordinates. And then the final step, in order to figure out what the size of the object is that he's actually measuring, is to use this warp factor to infer the correct proper size in the Einstein metric. So the reason why this is a reasonable prescription to take is that that warp factor didn't depend at all on the mass of the black hole. It's completely insensitive to what object you have sitting in the geometry. Yep.
Do you correct for the fact that, you know, even for Schwarzschild, if you look at, you know, this measure of the horizon size, it's not...
Oh, so, yeah, I'm just trying to get an order of magnitude.
You're not worried about the factors of what you're doing.
Yeah. I'll maybe try and present it in a more precise way when we write it up. But for today, I'm just trying to get the scaling right. Okay, so we've set that measurement up in the on the supergravity side. And we're essentially looking at correlations of plane waves in this conformally related metric with these flat space coordinates x tilde. So if we map that into our quantum mechanics variables, we need to use the mapping that I showed you here. So the sums of these xi tilde squareds are just going to be related to the u coordinate in that way. Okay, so we get this rather peculiar vertex operator that we want to compute in the quantum. What does that mean?
That's the minus bar pass at the end of the vertex.
That's right, yeah.
For each component?
You want to think of it as the whole matrix, I guess. But well, sorry.
C1 times the x1 to the minus 5 times.
Yeah, I guess you want to put a trace in there.
Where did that come from?
So,
well, I mean, see that the middle step is sort of irrelevant because you can see the basic final step. A big step.
Let's see, so let me come back to that later. So we have this. Going from the middle line, bottom line. Let's see, so. This is, well, this is more or less using Yonea's mapping of the operators in the quantum mechanics into operators in the gravity theory. So let's see. So one does essentially the same kind of thing in the ADS-CFT correspondence. One, if we just focus on the very light modes, we solve, say, this wave equation for a dilaton, and we get some set of Bessel functions times plane wave factors. This is some particular linear combination of these Bessel functions. Maybe we can discuss this later. There are, you know, definitely some a lot of steps I'm missing out there. Okay, but at least schematically, I think you can see how things are working. If we approximate this type of correlation function using the mean field methods, we get this type of relation, and we can compute that quantity using these kind of ultraviolet cutoffs that we'd like to put in to isolate the low energy modes. So we can compute the expectation value of x squared just by integrating over this first peak, and we get this kind of formula. And we can evaluate that and get this t to the 4/5 dependence on x squared. So if I then go and plug that into my prescription for calculating the area of the horizon, I get exactly this t to the 9/5 dependence, which matches the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. So we can do these as essentially two independent calculations, one of computing this free energy, getting the t to the 9/5 dependence of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, and then we can do this type of scattering calculation where we just use the properties of the bosonic propagators that we've computed using the mean field results. And we get exactly the same t to the 9/5 dependence. So what we were, I guess, trying to do is to see if one finds this universal S equals A over 4 type of relation emerging from this quantum mechanics. So we do find agreement there, although we don't seem to see any completely universal mechanism for that emerging from this. It seems to still rely on the details of the dynamics of this quantum mechanics. Okay, so using those same set of relations, we can also obtain this rather suggestive relation between the size of the horizon, the temperature, and the entropy. And it turns out that this relation has a rather, appears in a rather universal way. It actually holds for all black holes that arise from the near horizon limit of black pea brains. Okay, so that maybe suggests this type of mean field approximation where we treat n squared degrees of freedom as being independent might be quite useful in these other situations. So this is true up to factors of order unity. Okay, so let me conclude then. So we've developed this mean field approximation scheme for matrix theory in the Etouff limit, and we've recovered quantitative agreement with black hole entropy and developed this kind of interesting detailed picture of what the microstates are that are giving rise to that black hole entropy. And we've also seen many features of the space-time geometry emerge. We can reconstruct the metric that some probe brain sees. We can see some stringy stretched horizon, and then we can do an independent measurement of the area of the horizon via scattering and seeing that all these things seem to agree with the supergravity predictions. So let me end there. Thank you.
Any questions? Carol?
Can you study black hole evaporation?
Let's see. So in the way we formulated everything in this Euclidean time formulation, that becomes something of a challenge. Although so with these densities of states that we've computed, we can go ahead and compute real-time correlation functions without too much trouble. But at the moment, there's still real-time correlation functions for some black hole that's in equilibrium with some thermal bath. But yeah, that's something we're still thinking about, and I think we'll
probably with the condition of flow of these zero.
That's right. Yeah. That's the kind of thing we can compute, and is related to that kind of scattering cross section I was mentioning.
Yeah. So, rather than scatter these conformal Taylor fields, which involve those finite operators e to the i, x to the whatever, why not just scatter these zero brains? I mean, isn't it easier to think of just scattering at the zero brain and seeing whether it gets absorbed or gets?
We are essentially doing that. I think you can think of those amplitudes as scattering a probe brain off and coming back.
Start with the zero brain and some momentum staying out here.
You write down essentially all the light supergravity modes in terms of these zero brain vertex operators, essentially. So,
seems surprising you approximate a couple climate change problems so well. I mean, are there other examples like the anharmonic oscillator where these things like this are known to work, so you kind of have some confidence that.
Is that an example? Is there a similar thing there? Yeah. So a French group has worked out the anharmonic oscillator case in a fair amount of detail.
In your example, it doesn't work to arbitrarily strong couplings. It works for a while, and I guess if you work harder, it works for longer. Resummation or something that enables them to sort of try to go
For the anharmonic oscillator.
I'm
not so familiar with that case. I mean, I guess for the ON vector model, if you do this kind of thing, you get the exact answer. But there you don't have to work so hard. But
how about if you do it for resonance and increasing to bear, where you sort of know what the exact answer is?
So Dan and Gilad had a paper a few years ago where they went through a number of different toy models, some with supersymmetry, And in some cases, they knew the exact answer and were able to see that, that this type of expansion would often converge, even though you didn't have any a priori reason for it to work. So yeah, there are examples where you can check that it does agree with some exactly soluble case.
Okay. Any more questions? Science speaker again.